These first two stories are pretty nice. The one we get the image of the sheep that is lost and Jesus goes, finds it. He couldn't have been lost for long. If I look on this thing, this sheep doesn't look like he missed any meals. So if that's what he was like, it must have been a little bit hard to carry. Story of the two coins is nice. This woman finds her coins, celebrates, and is happy. It's that third story, that story of the prodigal son, that haunts me. And because it haunts me, I sort of want to talk to you about what I was thinking about as I keep reading and thinking about that story. Maybe something in that story will strike you to keep you thinking about it a little bit. The first thing is, unlike the other two stories, the prodigal son story is kind of like it just ends and you don't really know what happened. Did the son go back? Did he come, the older son come back and they had a big party? Did the younger son realize what he was and he stayed at home now for the rest of his life? And we don't hear that, and they lived happily ever after. And so that haunts me a little bit on why, what does that mean? What does it talk about? So I'm just going to give you some of the random thoughts that I thought about as I was thinking and reading and telling you why this story haunts me. The first random thought is, God has no statute of limitations in his forgiveness. There's no time limit. There's no offense that he won't forgive. That's really a very, very gracious God. And in fact, that's one of the criticisms that people have of our Catholic faith, both within the faith and outside. They say we have too soft a God. He'll forgive everything. So that, oh, you can just go sin and just go to confession and he'll forgive you, so do what you want. That's what people really think. And my answer to that is, yes, we do have too forgiving God. But he's too forgiving according to our standards. Our standards of forgiveness usually is, I'll forgive you, but you got to pay the price. You got to offer up, you got to go on, you got to pay your prison sentence. You got to go and do what you have to do to make up for what's going on. And so we always are exacting, we want revenge. We want to have people pay for what they did, except if it's our own child that committed the crime. Then we want leniency. We want probation. We want to forgive our child. That's a difference between us and God. And that's why our God looks so generous to us. He looks too generous sometimes to us. The second thing that I heard is that as you read that story, you hear about the fact that God welcomes him back. He's looking for him. He's not just waiting at home for a phone call. He's not just saying, well, you finally showed up, didn't you? He waits for him. That generosity is really important for people who have serious sin in their lives. If anybody's ever committed what they consider a really serious sin, one they couldn't talk about, one they can't even think about, one that they say, God won't love me because he'll find out that I did this. People with serious sin need to hear that God's waiting for them out there. And when they hear that, they know of a God that can love them and that they can be loved no matter what. The second part that I read about is when they say he came to his senses. He came, he was sitting in the pigsty. People that have serious sin and lived in the pigsty need to come to their senses to understand. What does that mean? It means that you're willing to look in the mirror with your sin and say, I've sinned. You don't hide anymore. When you come to your senses, the first thing you do is admit that you sin. And you admit that you're going to go back to God with what you're going to do. We all know many people that don't come to their senses because they're too embarrassed or they just don't want to. They're people that feel done to in their lives. At the least, it's people that we know that they can't be happy, that no matter what you say to them, they'll say, wait for the other shoe to drop, wait. At the worst, they're people that wallow around in their own bitterness and envy that they were done to. This happened to me, so my life is miserable. I'm never going to be happy. I can't be happy. Look at me. I'm a miserable person. We know people like that. We don't like to go visit them. But what we know is that when you come to your senses, that's the first time that healing can occur. And that was another thought. You can't be healed until you come to your senses from what you do. I find that I'm haunted by all this because when it comes to coming to our senses, I thought about Jesus for a second. I thought that from Jesus, it's not enough that we say he was crucified on the cross, but we as Catholics say he was scorned, he was rejected, he was reviled. We say all these terrible things about Jesus on the cross. Why do we do that? Isn't it enough that this innocent man was nailed to the cross? No, we say he was reviled and rejected. As a little sidebar, I thought, you know, we say that in our Catholic faith because of these people that wallow around in their own misery, that Jesus came even to save them. Just as these people feel reviled and feel rejected, Jesus felt that way as well, and he came to save them as well. What does it mean to come to your senses? The best thing I've had is a little quote here by St. Teresa of Avila. She says, every difficulty in prayer comes with one fatal flaw, that of praying as if God is absent. Or more broadly, looking for God as if he were absent. Coming to your senses is realizing that God never left you. You left him. You went away and went into the pigsty. He's still there. Coming to your senses is understanding that you don't have to pray or do or get anything back and say, okay, God, if I do this, will you come back? God is always there. Coming to your senses is that realization that you don't need to pay back for what you have done. One of the reasons why that bothers me and haunts me, this story, is because I know I have not been that gracious in my life. And that's what haunts me about it. I was divorced in my first marriage. And why that's important is that because it's important to the story because I had three daughters. And because of that, I'd only see my daughters on Wednesdays and every other weekend. And as that, trying to be a father to them was very difficult because as they got older, if they didn't like what I said, if they didn't like something in my house, they'd just go home. Okay, we'll go home. Or they'll just put up with it and then they'll go home and do what they want. So it was a very difficult time in my life to feel that I could teach them and be a father to them. When my oldest daughter was, I think she was a senior. I know she was over 18, but I think she was a senior at college at Madison, or she was starting her first year of master's degree. My youngest daughter graduated, and she went to college there too, and they lived together. And I was a little bit hesitant about them living together, but I thought, well, my oldest one could watch over my youngest one, and it'll be okay. Well, my stepson, who loves to tell me things that my kids do, said to me, well, you know what? He said, I saw your oldest daughter give your youngest daughter a joint. They were smoking a weed together. And I was livid because I hate stuff. I just hate drug stuff. I just don't want anything to do with it. I was livid. I didn't grab my older daughter. I yelled. I said, Amanda, I said, why did you do such a thing? I said, I didn't want Kelly to be up there with you. She's young. She's impressionable. What are you doing? And she, of course, never said sorry. She said, Dad, what's the big deal? Don't make such a big deal out of this. And I got so angry with her. I said, Amanda, I said, until you can understand what you have done and say you're sorry, I don't want to see you again. She went home, and I didn't see her for a year. I didn't see her for Thanksgiving. I didn't see her for Christmas. I didn't see her for Easter. And all the time, the other two girls would come and, Dad, you got to go talk to her, Dad. But I said, no, I told her she's got to come to me. She's got to come to me. I'm not going to say I'm sorry. I'm not going to go talk to her. She needs to come and say she's sorry to me. After about a year, we finally reconciled. I can't exactly remember how we did it, but it was only partial. She didn't come on my knock into my door, "Oh, Dad, I'm so sorry." And I didn't go to her and say, "Oh, man, no, you got to talk about this." Somehow we reconciled it, but we never, our relationship was never the same. Something died because of that event that we went through. And it's been 10 years later. I just saw her because my young Kelly just got married. And I just saw her, and we have a great relationship, but I can still tell when I look in her eyes there's something missing between us because of this. I was not gracious enough with that. And that's, I think, what haunts me the most about this prodigal son story. The son came, and all he wanted was, "Treat me like a servant. I screwed up. I messed everything up. Don't treat me special. Just treat me like a normal person." That's what we normally would do. We'd say, "Oh, you screwed up. You lost all your money. Come back here, and if you work it off for me." Not God. God's graciousness extends past anything we could think of. In all the stories, what happens, he finds a lost sheep. He doesn't just say, "Oh, that's great." No, he calls all his friends in. "Let's have a party." Lady Lupin finds a coin. She says, "Oh, let's have a party." Probably spends more money than the coin was worth. And in our story here, the prodigal son, he doesn't just say, "Well, you're finally back home, aren't you?" No, he puts on the finest robe. "Let's get the fatted calf. Let's get everything there." The graciousness for somebody that has sinned isn't just forgiveness, but it's forgiveness beyond the expectation of anything we could do or imagine. And that's what haunts me, because I can't do that. We're supposed to be in the mind of Jesus, a mind that doesn't hold grudges, doesn't exact payment, doesn't charge fees, doesn't say, "I'll forgive you if." We feel so good when we forgive somebody because we feel so special. "I forgave you. Aren't I great?" God doesn't even care about that at all. And that's what haunts me, is that I can't be like that. It's so hard for me to be in the mind of God and how different it is. Who do you know in your lives that you could just say, "We're done. I don't care what was between us. I don't care what it was. We're done. Come back to my house. Come, let's put the robe on you. Let's just forget everything else." Can we do that? That's what haunts me, is it's so hard to do. And the final thing that haunts me is that if you're here, Jesus, when he's trying to tell us about God's mercy, how it's like, he can't give us a real example. He has to make up a story. We are so unforgiving of our nature that he couldn't say, "Well, it's like a husband forgives his wife," or a mother forgives her child, because we know that that's always partial. Every time I hear about the prodigal son, I think of my daughter and how she was partially repentant and I was partially forgiving, and what it did to our relationship. And here Jesus had to make up a story to tell us about God's mercy, because he couldn't figure out anything in the real world that happens like that. And that's what haunts me as well.